It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about karmic captivity and questionable quandaries. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of The Vesper's Bell and Richard Morgan are voice talents Olivia Steele, Jeff Sturdivant, Steve Gray, Nick Goroff, Kyle Stroud, and Melissa Medina. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by The Vesper's Bell and is performed by Olivia Steele, Jeff Sturdivant, Steve Gray, and Nick Goroff. In it, a young lady finds a fairy trespassing in her neighbor's radish garden, only to be mistaken for a radish herself. Now, without further ado, I present to you Amongst the Radishes.
You bleed moron. That's not a radish. That's a human girl.
I heard the unseelie creature squawk as he gesticulated wildly down towards me. I had been bound up, gagged, and tossed on top of a cart overflowing with radishes the size of apples. They were all bright and shiny reds, pinks, purples, and blues, looking more like Easter eggs than root vegetables. One of my neighbors, Mrs. Clarion, had been growing them since long before I was born. Nearly her entire backyard had been turned into a radish garden, with only some flower beds and shrubs skirting the perimeter, and a small corner dedicated to an assortment of other household staples. I had asked her more than once over the years what on earth she needed with so many radishes, and each time she had always replied, "The fair folk's blessings do not come cheap." I believed her the first time she said this, stopped believing it when I got a little older, and then abruptly started believing it again when I caught one of them skulking amongst the radishes under the light of a full moon. I hadn't realized he was a fairy at first, of course. From a distance, I just thought it was a skinny, shabby vagrant raiding a local garden for food. Since I was so close to both home and friendly neighbors, I was perhaps bolder than a girl my age should have been in that situation. I stormed into the garden, waving my phone around, threatening to call the cops if the trespasser didn't get the hell out of our neighborhood. Only when he looked up at me did I remember that many old folk tales have supernatural beings, from mischievous pucks to Saint Peter himself, disguised as beggars to test the virtue of the unwary. And I, it seemed, had just failed. I saw a set of gold-flecked obsidian eyes gleaming in the moonlight, set deeply into a protruding and elongated face. His skin was a dull and orcish green. His nose long and ears pointed, his cheekbones sharp as knives and high as bell towers, and his dirty white hair hung about him in a tangle of unkempt dreadlocks. He was leaning on what looked like a shepherd's crook, with a carved-out radish dangling from it, a free floating flame with no apparent source burning brightly inside the hollow. I was so stunned by the being's undeniably inhuman appearance that I just gawked at him for a moment, and he took advantage of my inaction to swipe my legs up from under me with his cane. Even though he looked decrepit, he moved with a surprising amount of speed and grace, bouncing about as if he could refuse to obey gravity on a whim. I was helpless as he tied me up without a word and threw me into the cart with the rest of his haul. Mustering what seemed to be all of his might, he began pushing his heavily laden cart over to the doors that I had always assumed led to Mrs. Clarion's root cellar. But what I could now see was actually a set of rails that plunged deep into the earth. I screamed as loud as I could for help, but the gag muffled me enough that no one was able to hear me. As soon as the cart was on the track, the hobgoblin thing groaned in relief and hopped onto the back. With the tap of his cane, the cart began rolling forward, slowly at first, but gradually picking up speed as it chugged deeper and deeper underground, until we were barreling down the tunnel at a breakneck pace. Every time we spun around a sharp bend, I was sure the cart was going to capsize and kill us both. But whatever fairy magic was pushing it forward also held it and its contents firmly to the track. The only light came from the flame dangling from the goblin's cane, so I couldn't see very far ahead. It felt like we made a lot of turns, though, and I know we passed by at least a couple of junctions, implying the existence of a vast network of unseelie tracks crisscrossing far below the surface. When we finally started slowing down, we came into a vast cavern filled with stockpiled radishes, some of the heaps reaching all the way up to the ceiling. The cave was lit by thousands of hollowed radishes dangling from the stalactites by dewdrop-laden threads of gossamer that fractured their light into fractal rainbows. I saw hordes of unseelie busily carving out radishes and spooning out the insides into wooden tubs so they could be stomped into what I could only assume was some kind of god-awful goblin wine. My captain meticulously tried to steer his cart through all the ruckus and rumpus toward one of the great radish heaps, but was stopped by one of his fellow fair folk, the one who had so astutely pointed out that I was not a radish. Acknowledging my presence for the first time since he bound me up, he glared down at me in the violet gloom of the cavern. He was squinting tightly, as though he was trying to weigh his comrade's accusation that I was not, in fact, a radish.
"Are you sure?"
he asked at last, looking back over to the other fae.
"She's awfully red in the face, and she was awfully concerned about the welfare of all these radishes here, which seems to me to be an odd state to be in if you yourself do not also happen to be a radish. She might be a radish, Nilthorn. She just might."
"Aimswitch, radishes do not have faces to be read in. They do not have minds to be concerned, or voices to speak said concerns. And, most notably, they do not have mouths to gag or limbs to bind."
Nilthorn sighed, his voice heavy with exasperation.
"Now just hold up a minute there,"
Haimswich objected. I could tell by the look on his face that he was in the process of concocting some kind of harebrained excuse for bringing me down to this mystical Underheim of theirs.
"Mandrakes are root vegetables, just like radishes, if you follow me. Mandrakes dream of being human, and if they dream hard enough, their roots start to take on human form. You pull them out of the ground before they've turned all the way, and they're known to get awfully ornery, just like this young lass was. I don't think it's completely inconceivable that a radish might accomplish something similar once in a blue moon or so, especially when there's fairy magic involved. We could have an exceptionally rare and successful instance of self-willed transmogrification on our hands here."
"She hardly looks like she just crawled out of the ground,"
Nilthorn said, looking me up and down with an incredulous eye.
"And what about her clothes and makeup and a little gizmo on her wrist there?"
"What about them?"
Haimswitch shrugged.
"Roots grow around discarded human bric-a-brac all the time. It's no wonder, none at all, she'd be attracted to them, if anything."
God knows how much longer he'd have carried on with this nonsense, had my frustration with it not grown strong enough to overcome my shock and terror with the surreal situation he dragged me into. I try to scream through my gag, my voice, of course, coming out muffled and muted. They'd both look down at me, Hameswitch with alarm and Northorn in mild but still irritated vindication.
She just said that she's not a radish.
Northorn insisted.
You don't know that. She's got a gag in her mouth.
Hameswitch countered.
She could be saying anything. She could have said, time for hot haggis, or fine lot of catfish, or even sublime yachts or rubbish. It's impossible to tell.
I screamed as loud as I could. I was thrashing against my bindings now, and I could feel the knots around my wrist starting to come loose.
She's clearly saying that she's not a damn radish,
Northorn shouted.
Well, of course she is. She spent all that time in the dirt dreaming of being something more. It feels so real,
Hameswitch claimed.
What do you think mandrakes are screaming about when you pull them out of the soil? About how they're not bleeding mandrakes? That's what I'd wager.
Hameswitch, would you please stop wasting both our time and just admit you got caught?
Northorn sighed.
Oi, you're taking her word over mine? That's a bloody outrage it is,
Hameswitch declared.
Between her and me, which of us do you think really has the most incentive to lie about whether or not she's a radish?
You, because you're the one who got caught harvesting the radishes.
Exactly. I was harvesting radishes. I harvested her. Therefore, ergo, forthwith, ipso facto, et tu Brutus, she's a radish. Why would I have brought her back here if she wasn't?
Oi, Hameswitch, what's that you got there?
One of the other Unseelie asked. I noticed that a crowd of them had started to form around us. Whether it was due to my presence or just Hameswitch's bizarre ramblings, I'm not entirely sure.
A radish,
Hameswitch replied with the slightest hesitation.
Don't you know a radish when you see one, Kingsley?
Kingsley stared down at me, skeptically arching an eyebrow.
I dare say I do. And that, Hameswitch, tain't no radish. That there's a human girl, if I ever saw one,
he replied.
That's what I told him,
Northorn agreed. I shouted again, though I regretted drawing attention to myself since I was now nearly free of my ropes.
Radish says what?
Hameswitch mumbled. What? I heard someone in the crowd shout back, prompting Northorn to shake his head in frustration.
Hameswitch, enough. You're not fooling anyone. You've got to take her back up,
he ordered.
Hold on now. Hold on. Let's talk about this for a tick,
Hameswitch pleaded.
What if we just throw her on the heap for now and see if she takes?
She is not going on the radish heap, Hameswitch.
Why not?
Because she's not a radish.
And we can't have unprofessionals mucking around amongst the radishes. It will cause an avalanche. Or worse, a stampede,
Kingsley claimed.
Toss her in an empty cart and haul her back up to the surface.
Oi, we can't send her back now, lads. She seemed too much of our clandestine arcane operations,
Hameswitch claimed.
We can't risk her telling the others. They have sent the Grimms down after us for sure. It's obvious what we're up to.
All the goblins looked at each other uncertainly, and then around at the convoluted setup they had created for themselves.
Is it?
One of them finally asked.
I know this place like the back of my hand, and I'm still not 100% sure what we're doing,
another chimed in. By now, I had managed to wriggle loose from my ropes, but as I tried to get up, I caused the pile of radishes I was lying on to slide out of the cart and dump me onto the ground with them. Though the Unseelie seemed startled by my sudden escape, none of them made a move against me. I quickly scrambled to my feet before any of them could change their minds, pulling the gag out of my mouth with my now freed hand. I am not a radish! I shouted clearly for the first time.
Well, why didn't you say so?
Hameswitch asked innocently.
Northorn, it seems I've unknowingly picked up a stowaway. What say we see her on her way, why don't you?
Sighing and shaking his head again, Northorn took a cautious step towards me with his hands held up in a non-threatening gesture.
Just stay calm, kid. No one's going to hurt you,
he said as gently as he could in his gravelly, crackling voice.
I'm sorry you got dragged into this. Hameswitch was supposed to just vanish if he got caught and come back for his harvest when the coast was clear. But he's an idiot, and tossed you into his cart instead. Just step into one of the empty carts and have one of my workers, not Hameswitch, take you back home.
No. No, stay back. I'm not letting any of you take me anywhere! I screamed, picking up a radish and holding it as threateningly as I could, which wasn't very much, considering it was a radish.
Fine, have it your way. You want to go wandering up the tracks yourself in the hopes of finding the door you came through? Be our guest,
Northorn said.
We've got better things to do than fight with you.
Well, we have other things to do. I don't necessarily know about better,
Gingsley added.
Can it? The break's over. All of you get back to work this instant. I want every new radish shined and sorted by sunup.
Northorn barked. No, I'm not going to wander through goblin tunnels by myself, I shouted. You are going to magic me back home right now, or I will knock down that huge pile of radishes.
What do you mean, magic you back? What would we be using these tracks for, if we could do something like that?
Northorn asked.
Kid, either one of us drives you back up in the cart, or you're on your own.
I cocked my arm, ready to chuck the radish I was holding into a particularly large and precarious pile of radishes that I judged to be within throwing distance. Northorn's reaction was once again one of exasperation, and he seemed to be just waiting for me to get it over with. Infuriated, and already close to vomiting on the overpowering stench of radishes, I threw the one I was holding into the pile. It landed dead center and sent a few more radishes tumbling, but the pile otherwise remained intact. Northorn just shook his head and started to walk away, and I picked up another radish with the intention of throwing it at the back of his head. We were both stopped in our tracks by the sound of more radishes falling loose from the pile. I had expected to see radishes falling from the top half of the pile, but instead I saw them rolling out from the bottom. They hadn't been pulled down by gravity, but were apparently being propelled by some kind of magical force, and they were rolling towards me.
Stampede!
Gingsley shouted, sending all the goblins into a panic as they frantically fled in the opposite direction. Not fully realizing the danger I was in, I simply stepped backwards, thinking that the radishes would lose momentum before they could get to me. To my dismay, they actually picked up speed despite the flat floor they were on, and the faster they moved, the more radishes from the pile joined them. With a yelp, I threw the radish I was holding at them, only for them to weave out of its path before honing back in on my position. I broke into a sprint and began searching desperately for any form of safety I could get to. I noticed that the goblins had all gotten off the floor and hauled themselves up onto elevated platforms built into the cavern walls or suspended from the ceiling. But a radish stampede still wasn't enough to make me want to throw my lot in with theirs. Instead, I hopped into one of the carts, hoping that it would be sufficient high ground against the onslaught of heel-high terrors. I made it in just as the tsunami of radishes slammed into its back end. The cart lurched forward, but the radishes quickly circled round it and cut it off from the other side. They piled up higher and higher, and I knew it was only a matter of seconds before they started pouring into the cart. I was completely surrounded, with no way of escape other than just plowing straight through them. Hameswitch had controlled the cart with his shepherd's crook, and I saw that this one had a similar cane holstered to the rear end. Without a second thought, I grabbed it and started banging the outside of the cart with it as hard as I could. The cart immediately bolted forward, squashing the radishes in front of it and sending me slamming into the rear wall. When I looked up, I saw that the radishes had resumed the chase and were rolling after me in hot pursuit. The steering stick had flown out of my hand when the cart accelerated, so the only way I could steer it now was by shifting my weight around, and I had no way to slow down. My only hope was that the cart would stop on its own when it reached its destination. The rickety track had me bobbing up and down and nearly threw me out of the cart altogether. When I looked behind me again to see if I was at least making any progress in escaping the radishes, I saw that not only were they still chasing me, but that the goblins had joined the pursuit as well. They rode along the tracks on contraptions that resembled penny-farthing bicycles, and were trying to lasso what I could only assume was the alpha radish at the head of the pack. I whipped my head round to look forward, and I saw that the cart was heading towards a giant heap of rancid, rotting radishes. There were no other tracks for me to switch to, so if I didn't jump, a collision was imminent. But even if I survived the jump, I'd be crushed by the radishes that were chasing me. With no good options left to me, I braced myself for impact, while banging the walls of the cart with my feet, screaming for it to stop. It didn't listen, and I slammed into the mushy, fetid pile at full speed. The viscous concoction was enough to slow me to a stop as well as shield me from the pelting radishes coming from behind, but the stench was overwhelming and within a matter of seconds I'd fallen completely unconscious. When I woke up, I was gagged and bound again, but realized to some relief that I was back on the surface.
I'm just saying that that was what you would most definitely call an atypical reaction.
I heard Hameswitch say, and saw that I had been slung over his shoulder, and that he was carrying me through Mrs. Clarion's radish garden.
Why would they chase after her like that if she wasn't one of their own? I don't care how many limbs or eyes or whatever non-radish parts she may have. I still think that she could very well be some hereto unknown specimen of radish, or at the very least, some sort of crossbreed.
Ameswitch.
Northorne huffed, barely hanging on to his last thread of patience.
Shut up.
Ameswitch set me down by Mrs. Clarion's back door, and Northorne pounded on it in a secret knock before the two of them ran back off down the track, shutting the cellar doors behind them. A moment later, the back porch light came on, and Mrs. Clarion opened her door to find me tied up on her welcome mat, covered in stinking radish mulch. Though she did look alarmed, she didn't help me immediately. Instead, she picked up a letter that had been pinned to my ropes and made a point of reading it aloud.
Mrs. C, we recovered this during this moon's radish harvest. After extensive debate amongst ourselves, we were unable to come to a unanimous conclusion as to whether or not it constitutes a radish, though we do note that it fervently maintains that it is not. Regardless, it introduced a severe adverse reaction in our strategic radish stockpiles and subsequently compromised the organic certification of our compost heap. As such, I'm afraid we cannot accept it as part of your sacrifice and return it to your care in approximately the same condition we received it. Regards, Nullthorn.
With a sigh, she lowered the letter and glared down at me in mild annoyance. Young lady, what on earth are you doing in my radish garden at this time of night?
I hope you enjoyed Amongst the Radishes, as written by the Vespers Bell and performed by Olivia Steele, Jeff Sturdivant, Steve Gray, and Nick Goroff. Olivia Steele is a voice actress who loves the spooky side of things. Her talent varies between gameplay, live stream archives, singing, and other voice-related things. Voice actor and 2016 Evil Idol champion Nick Goroff's talents can be found on our very own Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, as well as on past episodes of the Simply Scary podcast. You can also join Nick on his YouTube channel, Wizard of Cause. Our second tale of the evening is written by Richard Morgan and is performed by Kyle Stroud, Jeff Sturdivant, Steve Gray, and Melissa Medina. Sometimes demons haunt hotels. Other times they check into them. When George Jackson has to find a hotel room for his young mistress on short notice, the truth is somewhere in between. So without any further ado, I present to you Curse of the Grey Stay Inn.
Sometimes demons haunt hotels. Sometimes they check into them. George Jackson's phone rang for what felt like the 100th time. It was actually the third, but it was his wife, so it irritated him like it was the 100th. "Claire, I told you I'm on the road, and my headset needs charged," he growled into his headset. He was lousy at being a businessman, but he was an okay liar.
"I just really miss the sound of your voice, Georgie Porgy."
"We just got done talking 3 minutes ago, you blabbering vat of bacon grease." That's what he wanted to say. But what really came out was, "I know, baby, I know. Look, I'm making good time. I won't be a minute later than necessary. One last conference and I'm all yours, okay?" She whimpered and brayed and whined. None of it reached his flinty heart. All he heard was the way her words sounded. Flabby. When she put on the ring, she put on enough weight to make 2 or 3 more people. It changed the way she talked. A mushiness and nasal resonance that wasn't there before. God, it was annoying. Her weight was all that had really changed, but it was enough to spoil his appetite for her. "I want to get home to you safely, so I'm going to go now, okay? Okay. Bye." He ended the call. "You fat, worthless bag of slimy gravel. Ass looks like a garbage bag full of maggoty mashed potatoes. Don't you call me again. Don't you friggin' call me again." The phone rang again. The only thing that kept the bulging vein on his forehead from rupturing was the fact that it was Lois calling. Like the first sip of a fine whiskey, his pulse dropped.
"Georgie, baby,"
a sultry voice said in his ears. God, that voice was like Viagra. "I'm so glad to hear you," he said. "My phone won't shut up. Like my wife." Her giggle was deliciously triumphant.
"I could leave you alone if you want."
"No, no, please. Talk to me, baby. I need you. I'm driving all over God's green earth for conferences that could have been done virtually. But they seem to think it's better we're all in the same room together."
"Well, we can be in the same room together. You're still in the state, right?"
"You're at least 3 hours away, Lois. I might have to get a room for more than one night if we're going to rendezvous. Then I'll have to make up another story for my wife and my contacts both."
"Sounds like a plan to me. Let me know as soon as you have a room."
"Lois, I'm serious."
"So am I," she said.
He shivered at the way the temperature of her tone turned sub-zero. "All right, baby, all right. I'll get a room for us ASAP.
"I can't wait. Love you."
Do you know how hard it is when you need to find a hotel room for yourself and your young mistress on short notice? No? Well, George does. It's usually enough to just say, "Hey Google, hotels near me." Not that time. Not for George. Not only did the list come up woefully short, nearly every single one of them had no rooms. Well, okay, they had rooms. But Lois wasn't a woman to be bedded in just any room. She had expensive taste. Hence her crush on George. Hence also George's predicament. Claire would be fine with the cheapest room and whatever greasy burger was sitting at the bottom of the menu. Not Lois. She was a woman of extremes. In emotions, in food, in accessories, in bed. Especially in bed. If she didn't get any bruises, she got mad. "If it isn't making marks, it isn't making memories," she'd tell him. As long as he got to give and not receive said bruises, he was fine with it. Beads of uh-oh sweat started twinkling on his forehead. It looked like she was either going to have to settle for a sub-Lois room, or she was going to have to wait for another night. Both options were precarious. The sun was sinking, and dark was settling in early with a dismal fog. Just as George was about to make that fatal phone call, the fog vomited up a lonely hotel. He checked his map app. It wasn't listed. Was the place even open? The sign was lit up and flashing. It said, "Gray Stay Inn." The more important sign was also lit up. "Vacancy." He groaned at the fact that he couldn't just call from the comfort of his car. No listings and no phone number. But he didn't dare nix his luck. He stretched his head forward and eyed the exterior. It had the appearance of a fine hotel, if a bit drab, but he attributed that to the fog. The inside was decked to the nines. The crystal chandelier hung high like an inverted Christmas tree made of ice. Twin staircases wound up and away, to the left and the right. Under the chandelier was a fountain of a marble woman pouring water out of a jar. It was the kind of fountain that didn't sound like someone urinating, an effect difficult to avoid. That alone told George that it might be Lois's kind of place. But the color scheme was certainly muted, all gray and monochrome with minimal contrast. If there had been a bright ivory white or a jet black somewhere, George's eyes could have gotten some relief, but there was no such thing. An older man with a shiny, spotted, bald head approached him.
"Ah, a guest this dreary eve. How do you do, sir? I'm Colin Simmons, manager of the Gray Stay Inn. Welcome, welcome, welcome."
He shook George's hand with a ritzy gray glove. The man's pallid head seemed to float in the air as his suit was a plain gray like the surrounding decor. It made the close-cropped white hair around his ears bright as snow and sunlight. "This place makes sex with my wife sound exciting." That's what George wanted to say. Rather, what came out was, "I think your interior designer was colorblind." Mr. Simmons laughed.
"So it would seem, sir, so it would seem. But such an environment makes sleep come quickly. I trust you'll be finding out for yourself, eh?"
"I need a room fit for a queen. Like, on the level of outshining the royalty of ancient Egypt." The little old man clucked his tongue and grimaced.
"I understand. Well, there's our Empress Suite. It's got a balcony with a dining area. The north wall is a projector screen, and it dwarfs the assets of some small theaters. The fabric on the bed is an exclusive import from..."
"That sounds amazing. You've sold me. Ring me up."
"The deluxe package includes an exclusive menu from the dining room and the bar both. Plus, it takes priority over other guests. Your food will be served hottest and fastest."
"Again, I'm sold." And he was. Colin's windy words didn't do the opulence of the room justice. It truly was a luxury space, the stuff of sweet champagne with extra bubbles. It almost compensated for how mind-numbingly dull the colors were. George's red silk tie shone like a beacon in the ornate mirror at the other end of the room. He found himself more agitated than soothed by the muted ambience. But after all, it wasn't about him. This time. There was a knock at the door. It was Mr. Simmons, beaming.
"Mr. Jackson, I thought I'd come ahead of the parade of our servers and bring you up to speed on our procedures. We want this to be your palace and you its king. We do ask of you that you wear these in the meantime."
He held out a sharp business suit, a bathrobe, and some casual clothes that included undergarments. Each article was on its own hanger and under a protective cover of plastic. They also looked like they'd been tailored to George's exact measurements. But they were all gray and neutral. Like everything. George smiled and waved his hand. "No, thank you. I've brought plenty of my own clothes." Never before had George seen a smile gone from someone's face so quickly and so completely. It left Mr. Simmons's mouth and eyes in a snap. Oh, but then it was back and dialed up a notch, bringing out crow's feet and allowing George to see all the way back to the hollows in his jaws.
Whatever you've packed won't be as comfortable as what we are providing. We want you to have the full gray stay in experience. By the time you slip these on, you'll forget that it's part of our policy.
Are you trying to tell me this place has a dress code? Is this a hotel or an academy? Mr. Simmons's PR mask crumbled. He puffed his cheeks at the carpet as he weighed his words.
You've got me, Mr. Jackson. In all my years of managing this place, I haven't been able to conjure up a good spiel. But I will ask you to take me at my word when I say that I'm doing this out of regard for your safety. Please don't make me explain myself if my spiel is hard to digest. The truth is much more so.
Tell me the truth and I'll wear your yawn johns. The old man stared into George's eyes, apparently making a series of careful calculations.
All right. We have a presence here. A very hedonistic presence.
What? A ghost that's in love with boring decor? George scoffed.
No, quite the opposite. Its affinity is with all things flamboyant and stimulating and, arousing, and I cannot speak to whether it's a ghost or not. All we know is that it's here, and it's got a terribly sensual appetite. Our lovely inn used to be quite the display of golds and crimson and pearl, but after the thing arrived, we had to take measures so as not to bring ruin to our business or our guests. It's imperative that its brain perceive us as boring. That shimmering red tie of yours, if it sees that, you risk having a terribly regretful attachment, and I won't be able to help you, which is why I'm trying to help you now.
Mr. Simmons stretched out the clothes to George with eyes like Oliver Twist. And, does this thing have a name?
It's the Raffle.
A raffle? George chortled.
Raffle! Please, Mr. Jackson, I'm as serious can be.
I like you, Mr. Simmons, George said as he took the clothes from the old man, who then looked like someone who just set down a burden he'd been carrying for miles. The door closed. He looked the clothes over, paying special attention to the suit. They were finely made, of that there was no doubt. But the colors... ugh. It was almost the kind of suit that you would wear in the back of a hearse. There was a sterling silver wastebasket next to his feet, and he plopped the provided clothes in it. A business card fluttered out of one of the bags. Perfect. He'd be able to give Lois directions to the place. He called her, really talked the room up. The best part was he didn't have to lie. He phoned downstairs and ordered a fine cognac. The young woman who delivered it advised him to change into the provided clothes as soon as he possibly could. He thanked her, ignored her advice, and went to give the projector a test run. Whew, it was sharp. Collie boy wasn't lying. The picture quality was impeccable, as if the wall was a television screen. He did discover, though, that the selection of movies were all films in black and white. He scratched his head at this. Lois wouldn't mind. As long as she was kept happy, he was okay with the hotel's weird ways. The in-room freezer had an ice maker that specifically made those spherical ice cubes for alcoholic drinks, and they were clear as crystal. The alcohol seeped into his veins, and the movie that was playing got more interesting as a consequence. The hours wore on as he waited for Lois to show up. The more he drank, the more impatient he got. Then he remembered. During their last meetup, Lois had given him her tablet. She said there was something special on it, just for him. They were very, very naughty home videos. Lending him the tablet avoided an indelible record that would be left if she sent him a file transfer. She would just get the tablet next time they met up. So, it was time to get some more mileage out of the works of movie director Lois Calhoun. He was yanked out of his happy place when he heard laughter ring out from a corner of the room. His blood turned to ice. There was no way. It was Claire's whinnying, barking laugh. Normally, the sound of that awful laugh made his blood boil, but this time, it froze like a slushy. But when he looked to see his wife's triumphant, cackling face, there was no Claire. There was the most bizarre thing he had ever seen in his life. If someone had flayed a dozen orphans and stitched the meat and skin into some kind of ungodly flesh potato, with a gaping mouth and twiggy legs that bent backward at the knee, it would have looked like this thing. It didn't have any eyes that George could detect, but it was facing him and reacting as though it was delighted at the start it gave him. The mouth was wide open and howling with his wife's laugh. Instead of hair, it had one long protuberance with a puckered end that flailed around. 8 smaller and ropier tentacles surrounding the protuberance like petals on some weird skin flower, curling and uncurling and whipping about. George staggered back, his senses overwhelmed. It caught sight of the tablet playing Lois's dirty movies. It made a sound like a wolf whistle and ambled over to the screen. The small tentacles began wrapping around the central protuberance on the creature's head. They writhed and caressed, and the monster began making a sound less like laughter. It was more stressed. By the time George regained himself and realized what the thing was doing, it was too late. Steaming green ichor jetted from the puckered end of the protuberance. The tablet hissed as it started dissolving. George found himself a spectator of his body as it moved on autopilot. Acid. The frickin' thing just gushed acid all over Lois's tablet, he said from somewhere in the back of his head. He ran like a locomotive and kicked the creature. It rolled like a beach ball, laughing hysterically. So he kicked it again, and again, and again. It laughed harder each time. If it had eyes, it would have been in tears. It must have reached a point where it had all the entertainment it could handle, because after it suffered one last brutal kick by George, who was now red as a tomato, the thing slipped under a dresser as if it had suddenly become as two-dimensional as a shadow. George went from crimson to pale. He poured a tumbler full of cognac with shaking hands and downed it without coming up for air. He was trying not to look at Lois's ruined tablet, but he did, and it was still ruined. Yeah, that actually happened. He was indeed visited by a beach ball meat monster that laughed like his wife, and it shot off all over his mistress's tablet. Speaking of his mistress, she knocked on the door. She was radiant, like a top-shelf hooker. George looked like a wax sculpture titled Constipation.
Georgie, baby, are you okay?
Yeah, he croaked. The booze here goes down a little too smooth, that's all.
Oh, you aren't kidding about this place. This has got to be the find of the century.
She twirled about like a little girl as she oohed and aahed about the hotel. Then she saw the mess that used to be her tablet.
Is that my... Wait, What the hell did you do to my tablet? Oh my god, is it melted?
George's brain couldn't come up with a good lie fast enough, so it loaded the torpedo tube with, "Don't worry, I'll buy you a new one. Something really screwed up happened before you showed up, and I can explain." And that might have actually been a good card to play. But it never hit the table, because a raucous laugh cut the moment and echoed off every wall like a ricocheting bullet. Worse still, it was George's laugh. But it wasn't coming from George's mouth. The look on Lois's face announced she wasn't able to discern this truth. Shock registered in her face. Coming up from underneath that shock was something dark. Something cruel.
So that's how you feel. Well, what else have I trusted you with that you won't take care of? My heart?
The stampede of a rant kicked off from there. She wasn't aware of the small creature with the flailing proboscis atop its eyeless, grinning head that stood behind her. It tilted itself in a manner that suggested recognition. It started stimulating itself again. George went into action and grabbed a whiskey glass and chucked it at the monster. Lois squawked and winced. The creature rolled out of the line of fire, cackling with George's voice. George surmised that his situation just got worse. And he was right. Lois resumed her breathless tirade and managed to up the heat a tick. From the standard, "You never loved me," and the customary, "You men are all the same." She got around to the stuff that would actually get George to quake in his wingtips. She never truly enjoyed rough lovemaking. It was a poker chip in a bid to take George's fortune. After each fresh set of bruises, she photographed them as evidence. He was paying her hush money to begin with, but now she was moving in for checkmate. As bold as you please, the little orphan meat monster once again came up behind her, still maintaining some distance. It gazed at her rump and couldn't resist. It began stroking and throttling its protuberance once again. A twinkle came to George's eye. Lois's furnace burned hotter and hotter until steam was practically coming out of her ears. Those alluring eyes had turned maniacal. Maybe the little monster was into girls like that, because it started trembling and chirping.
Mark my words, this is the last time you've pushed me, George Wilbur Jackson.
No. This is, he shouted, as he charged her and shoved her backwards with all his might. Time slowed down for George as Lois floated backwards, her rage replaced by shock. Smoke or vapor haloed her hair as the back of her head was doused in steaming acid. It worked fast. The pink bone of her forehead peeked out. And then her eyelids were gone. And then her nose. Her mouth clacked open in a lipless scream. The volume didn't ramp up much, since her vocal cords shriveled up and slid down into her stomach like tomato soup. Her skinless skull whacked the demonic little voyeur between the eyes, or where that spot would be if it had eyes. It laughed harder than ever and rolled in circles. As for George, he couldn't help laughing either. It was such a curious sound. George's laugh coming from two throats at the same time. Only one of the laughs was frayed with madness, but it was impossible to tell which one it was. The two monsters looked at each other, the smaller bouncing up and down, and the larger stooping with his hands on his knees. They understood each other. Gemini souls they were, or at least kindred spirits. Mr. Simmons was white as a sheet when he knocked on George's door. He heard the laughing, but how he prayed that he was mistaken. George answered. He was wearing the terrible drab bathrobe and an expression of confusion. Colin, hey, what can I do for you?
Sorry to bother you, Mr. Jackson, but if your visitor is to spend the night with you, she'll need to change her clothes herself.
Oh, no, you won't need to worry. She's already left. She ran me something I left behind at the last meeting. That's how you know you've got the best colleagues, am I right?
Quite. I also wanted to be certain of your well-being. I heard laughter that sounded, shall I say, abnormal. It's usually a sign of our resident entity.
The only phenomenon in here is how funny the movie is, man, George said, slapping his thigh. Colin nodded as his eyes roamed the robe wrapped around George.
All right, then. Sleep well. If you wish, you can keep the provided clothes.
You aren't gonna tell me more about this raffle thing?
You're putting me on, Mr. Jackson.
No, I'm serious. You've told me some, so you can tell me more, can't you?
Speaking of the thing tends to draw its attention. It's got quite the ego, and it shouldn't be stroked.
George guffawed with such a force that Colin took a step back.
Mr. Jackson!
Right. We shouldn't stroke its ego. I understand. Okay, I'm done. I swear I'm done. The look on Colin's face was probably reserved for the raffle, but it was directed at George. The two men nodded to each other as the door shut. George's phone dinged with a text message. It was his wife. She wanted to know how the trip was going. He told her that he had to stay at a hotel due to the weather. Her talent of jumping to conclusions kicked in, and she told him that he better not have anyone staying in the room with him. His reply? R-O-F-L.
I hope you enjoyed Curse of the Grey Stay Inn, as written by Richard Morgan and performed by Kyle Stroud, Jeff Sturdivant, Steve Gray, and Melissa Medina. Richard lives in the Midwest, Riverton, Illinois. Very much small town USA. What better place for writing horror? His crew consists of three cats, two kids, and his wife. He was a cake decorator before he took up writing full time. Don't worry, none of those cakes were poisoned. He produces his very own horror storytelling podcast, Marsh Lights, which can be heard on Spotify and most of the places you get your podcasts. You can keep up with him and his antics at richardmorganwrites.com. On to the shows. Longtime resident and powerhouse, Otis Gyre, has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. And please be sure to check out the other shows we offer on our network. We have Fear from the Heartland, featuring horror stories brought to you from the Heartland, airing Wednesdays. Then there's Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast that's dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. Now, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.